to advance our survival. My stomach was empty as I left the village at dawn. I carried a geopositioning receiver tuned to a satellite overhead, all that was left of the spaceship that had brought us here. I paused at the little cemetery, surprised to see that the yellow blooms above the three women's graves had become balls of dried petals, dead without going to seed. I knelt to examine the plants and dug into the soil. The sod fell to pieces in my hands. Perhaps we had been less careful replacing it than we had thought. My fingers brushing through the sod felt something firm, springy with life. A white shoot, like bamboo and wide as my thumb, rose from the soil. I found another, another and more. Snow vines sprouted from the three women's graves. The vines had sent out roots to feed on dead humans instead of aspen trees, to tap flesh for food and blood for water. One vine had killed them and the other was feeding on them, as if this were an earth war where corpses were left to be scavenged by crows and wild dogs. I whipped out my machete and hacked apart the colorless shoots without thinking, kicked open the soil to find every last one, and chopped them all to bits. Finished, panting in the thick atmosphere, I gazed at the east thicket, rising unperturbed, and realized I was a fool. This was no earth war, just Darwinian struggle. The cycle of life always reuses the dead, and I had succeeded only in despoiling the graves. I gazed at clods of soil, dead flowers, and white vines bleeding sap. I smoothed the ground as neatly as I could over the graves, and left. The sun had risen above the treetops. I explored the forest until the muscles and joints in my legs ached, but I found precious little for our colony. I had so much to learn. We knew that Pax was a billion years older than Earth. On Earth, plants had separated from animals less than a billion years ago. Probably Pax plants had had more time to evolve. The greenery around me held secrets I would never learn. We ate a small dinner in near silence that night. Yuri said that some of the yams had been poisoned, apparently from seepage from the wheat fields, despite the drought. Later, in bed, Paula awoke suddenly. "It might rain," she said. "Soon?" "It might rain a lot. The planet has seasonal storm patterns. It makes hurricanes, but they're big and low and move slow compared to Earth."
"Can we prepare for them?"
"Not much. Not much at all."
After a while, we both fell back asleep. I dreamed of my childhood and hunger. I awoke at dawn expecting gunfire, and remembered that I was far away from warfare and safe from soldiers, if not hunger. Before I went on my daily search for food, Yuri and I inspected the fields as the early morning sun cast long shadows. We checked the trench and the wheat below it. Less than one third of the crop had been saved, and it was wilting for lack of water. We kept walking. I stared down at the dusty, poisoned soil beneath our feet. "Maybe if we water lightly..." Yuri grabbed my arm so suddenly I tripped.
"Look!"
At the west end of the fields, at the top of the hill, like white spears, snow vine shoots rose 10 centimeters high. Sandy soil still clung to the sprouts. The field had been bare the night before. I had seen it myself. With one look, I understood the poison. "It's the vines," I said. Yuri stared wide-eyed at the shoots. "The snow vines poisoned the field. It's allelopathy. The plant gets rivals out of the way to clear space for itself. If we test them, we'll find them full of poison." They were. The snow vines had sent down roots more than a meter deep, found our irrigated field, exuded a poison, and taken the land for its own use. They were in the yam fields, too. "Plants try to expand. It's a natural thing," I explained in the lab to Yuri and Paula. But I felt troubled. The snow vines had sent their roots more than a half kilometer to attack the field, passing other fine, fertile ground. "I say destroy it," Yuri said with clenched teeth. "It killed Nainia. It will kill all our crops." Paula looked at him sternly. I stated an obvious fact. "It will not be easy to destroy. The thicket covers hectares with who knows what defenses."
"We stopped Napoleon. We stopped Hitler. We can stop a killer houseplant. We will not fall to siege."
Then Yuri caught Paula's look and smiled, as if he had told a joke.
"We're not at war,"
Paula said slowly, smiling back.
"It's only vines and trees."
Yuri saluted.
"I am a lumberjack of a soldier."
Paula's smile faded a bit. "If we were ever going to grow anything, we would need to control the vines, but we needed something in harmony with the environment." An idea occurred to me that I should have had much earlier. "Nature balances," I said. "Something has to be the natural biological control for the snow vines. We can find it and let the environment take care of itself. Yuri, let's go." Paula gave me a look of thanks. Our two thickets, east and west, were set apart by the wide meadow we lived in, and bounded by forest at either end. With machetes, guided by the geopositioning system, Yuri and I crashed through the forest to the north, sweating under gloves and heavy shirts to protect us from thorns and bug lizards and spiny flightless birds and coral tentacles. Every slash brought a different scent of sap to the air. Yuri swung hard at a poison ivy fern.
"We must find something as good as a missile," he said.
"We will need something even more powerful, but not a weapon. Something natural." He paused.
"You think we will find such a thing?"
"Have faith in nature. Whatever balances the snow vine has to be at least as powerful as it is." The first snow vine thicket that we located stood in the forest like an island 2 meters across, a cloud of white vines around a crest of aspen. They arched over our heads like tentacles reaching into the woods. One had wrapped around a palm tree, pulling it over, and another tentacle had clamped over the growth bud at the top. The palm was dying.
"Here is a job for a lumberjack soldier," I said. With a flourish, he saluted the thicket.
"We will meet in battle."
The satellite scan of the forest had located another thicket, big and split in the middle like a lizard eye. In miniature, it resembled the thickets bordering our meadow. At one end, a gap in the thicket opened like a doorway into the little meadow inside it. Above the doorway, vines arched toward each other and grappled. Thorns cut into other vines, and sap dripped onto the ground. One branch held a tattered piece of another vine clamped in a spiral grip. Yuri stared at it.
The plant grows very strange.
I understood it at a glance. Two plants, east and west.
Two soldiers,
he corrected, and laughed, entertained by his own idea. I could not manage a laugh. Inside we found tufts of grass falling over and rotten like the wheat in our fields. With my boot, I cleared away slimy remains to reveal a rotting aspen sapling that had belonged to one side or another. This might be the real target of the root rot. He studied it, looked around at the thickets on either side of us, and slowly smiled.
Life again makes sense. We are in a battlefield, a fight between two houseplants.
He was right up to a point. Plants always struggled against each other on Earth. They often fought to the death.
A fight, yes, I said, but for survival. They're not mere soldiers. And think how big our meadow is, how big the struggle to survive.
I looked around for any hint of a counterbalancing force to snow vines, and did not see one. A stink drew us to a lump of green turf, actually a bloated Fipocat corpse. Ripe fruit hung on the vines on one side of the meadow.
I bet these are poisonous, I said. Why kill a little cat? You said they fertilize the ground in the thickets.
Dead bodies might yield more fertilizer, or you could cut off your opponent's manure supply.
Plants are not that smart.
They adapt, I said. They evolve. At the university, we had joked about the ways plants abused insects to make them carry pollen or seeds. But insects were small. On packs, the snow vines were enormous. Next to them, humans and Fipocats were insects, objects to abuse. I pushed at the dead Fipocat with the toe of my boot. It was anchored to the ground, somehow. I prodded the corpse with my machete, holding my breath against the smell. A thick root emerged from its belly and buried itself in the soil beneath it. Something poked up under the fur. I sliced the poor thing open. Inside, a snow vine seed had germinated. I thought of the three women's graves. The west vine had employed them just like this Fipocat to carry away its seeds and use the dead bodies as fertilizer. I hacked off the shoot, springing out of the Fipocat. I had learned everything I needed to know. I knew what we were. I looked for Yuri, holding his machete like a sword. He had approached one of the thicket's walls and was walking slowly down its length. He kicked at the leaf litter and rotting grass on the ground. Leaves and twigs flew, and maybe bones. Beneath the litter, vine roots lay like slithering snakes, reaching out and winding around each other.
Madness! He shouted. Madness! We are being killed by fighting houseplants!
In the flying leaves, I saw our house in Veracruz explode in the corn war, thatch blasting through the air. My family fled through dying fields to the swampy forest, spy planes buzzing all around us. My mother tried to shield my eyes and told me to be brave, but I saw human bones in the woods, their stinking flesh falling away, and I screamed. Then my mother fell, blood bubbling from her chest and mouth. We had to leave her with the rest of the dead, and I had to be brave. Yuri had been in an army, but I had been in a war. Soldiers win victories, but civilians merely survive if they are lucky and clever. That can be enough, but the civilians may hate both sides, and I did. I had left Earth to escape them all. Every side in every war. "We can go," I said. "We can go." The people who caused the Corn War, both sides of that war, were greedy and cruel. But the vines were just vines. He pointed the machete at me. "The East Vine is already our ally, correct? It will serve us." "Only if we are great big fipocats and do what it wants." Yuri hopped like a cat.
"The fipocats will win then."
"Only if our vine wins." At my insistence, we dug up the graves of Carrie, Ninia, and Z. We found a mass of roots at war tangled through their flesh. The seeds from the West Vine had sprouted, stems and roots bursting through their abdomens. But roots from the East Thicket had countered, strangling the seedlings. The East Vine had won. I confessed to attacking the West Vine's seedlings. Yuri put an arm around my shoulder.
"You helped kill Ninia's killer, and Keris and Zis. You did us a service."
More than that, I had made a decision about the sanctity of a grave, something beyond the struggle to survive. I had brought a mind and a heart to Pax. At the conclusion of a meager dinner in the village plaza, snow vine fruit but no yams, no bread, and not much of the dehydrated mycoprotein we had brought from Earth, we held a Commonwealth meeting about the snow vines. I described how individual vines battled each other, poisoning other plants and using animals to provide fertilizer, to spread seeds, and perhaps more. We could probably transplant the East Vine to guard our fields, but... Half-Foot Wendy interrupted me.
"Perfect."
Other people nodded. "But we need to be its fipocats," I said. "We will work for it, not the other way around. It will help us only because it is helping itself. We give it food and water, our latrines and irrigation and cemetery, and we help it advance, just as if we were a colony of fipocats."
"That's fine," Wendy said, grinning. "We wanted to fit into the ecology. We won't be aliens anymore, and after only a couple of months. Oh, this is better than I thought."
But immediate success would be unlikely. We had to be overlooking something.
"Morrow,"
Paula said,
"tell us about fipocats. What are they like, and what do we need to do?"
He stood up and stroked his beard for a moment.
"They're herbivores, for starters. Camouflaged and not at the top of the food chain. And I've discovered lately that they can slide as well as hop." He continued talking. I wondered what we had not noticed. Ecologies adjust, but 2 months was fast, especially for plants. Intelligence made humans extremely adaptable as a species. We could probably learn within days to fully imitate fipocats if we had to make many changes. We already fulfilled many of their behaviors from the snow vine's point of view. Merle was saying,
"I believe I've seen them teaching each other things. They learn mighty fast."
The snow vines had learned fast, too. They had realized that we were like fipocats and used us like them, giving us healthy or poisonous fruit. But the West Vine had attacked our fields. It had noticed how we differed from fipocats, that we were farmers, and it had developed a plan that required conspicuous effort on its part. Creative, original ideas and perseverance were signs of intelligence. Real intelligence, insightful. It had weighed possible courses of action, then chosen one. Snow vines could think and plan ahead, and the West Vine had made a very aggressive decision.
It had decided to kill us every way it could, and had invented tactics to do it. We were civilians in a warlord's territory. We were in a genuine battleground. We were in terrible danger. I interrupted Merle. Do Fippocats grow crops? He looked at me like I was crazy, then shrugged.
Why, no, they don't. Not that I've seen. Not even burying seeds like squirrels, though they might come fall.
The snow vine attacked our crops. It knows we are not Fippocats. It is like the Corn War back on Earth. Controlling the food supply is one way to win a war.
Oh, come on, Brian said. It attacked the field because it was a good place for it to grow.
It had to go too far, more than a half kilometer, and it passed better places to grow, like the spring. It analyzed us and made a decision, a complex decision. Then the other snow vine decided to become our ally. They are smart enough to do that. They can think.
You never said this before,
Vera said. I only realized it now.
Plants can't think,
Paula rapped on the table.
Let's remember to be supportive and listen, not debate. We're here to solve a problem, not to win.
I gave her a look of gratitude, but she was looking at someone else with warning. I took a deep breath. They have cells I cannot identify. On Earth, plants can count. They can see, they can move, they can produce insecticides when the wrong insect comes in contact with them.
It could be an instinctual response, Merle said. Any animal decides what to do about its territory.
Plants struggle against each other for survival. They fight, I said. This is a war, an organized fight.
Oh, come on, Brian said,
then caught Paula's eye.
I mean, this is a lot to accept at once.
I know, I said, working hard to be patient. I want us to be sure we understand that we are picking sides in a war that is bigger than we are, and we are making one side a more determined enemy.
Enemy. A plant enemy, he muttered.
Everyone sat quietly for a minute. A couple of crabs started buzzing near Snowman.
Humans go to war because they're depraved.
Vera glanced at Paula, then continued more gently.
This is an ecosystem, so it all works together as a whole.
She was an astronomer, so of course she saw the universe as stars and planets with neat and predictable orbits. Everything worked out by math. The rest of nature would be the same.
The plants are fierce, Yuri said. Octavo is right about that. We must try to survive equally hard.
Grun nodded.
He's found out how to fit into nature, harsh as it is here. It's a risky plan, and it's good of him to make sure we know the risks, but it's a reasonable plan, and I like it.
I looked around. We all wore the same sturdy clothes, spoke the same language, and shared the same hopes. We had debated this back on Earth and reached an agreement. We would live in harmony with nature, and nature was always in harmony, like the gears of an old-fashioned clock. I knew that the vines had killed us deliberately, with malice and forethought, but that was too hard for anyone else to believe.
If plants are so smart, Brian said, where are their cities?
Now, it's an old planet, but it's new to us, Merle replied. We've not been here but a couple of months, and there's a lot to learn. We might be standing smack in the middle of a city and not be able to see it.
Still, we can't take too long before we decide what to do because we don't have that much time. The Phippacats have managed to live with the vines, and they're mighty smart for animals. We can do it, too.
This is the first place where I felt genuinely at home,
Wendy said.
We found what we wanted. We left Earth behind, didn't we? Pax will be at peace as long as we're at peace.
That's right,
Vera repeated.
We left behind the failed paradigms like war.
Perhaps I was using the wrong paradigm. You are right. It is an evolutionary struggle, and we need to fit in. But I do not know what this snow vine, either snow vine, is going to do next. We will have to keep on doing whatever they want. They might outthink us or use us and discard us. The east vine might not even fight for us.
Plants don't control animals, Merle said. Influence, maybe, so it's right to keep a weather eye. But they can't outthink us.
I thought about the agriculture back on Earth. Food meant money and power, and on Earth it was easy to spot the enemy. It had its hand in your pocket or its gun pointed at your chest. Paula said,
I think we all recognize that our decision might have unforeseen consequences. It will be all our decision, though, knowing that nothing's guaranteed.
If it doesn't work,
Ramona echoed,
it's not your fault, Octavo. I think we ought to try being a friend to the East Vine for a while.
It's that, or move the whole colony,
Vera said.
And we'd starve for certain. And there may be snow vines all over Pax anyway. Let's be practical.
They had no idea what they were agreeing to. But if they wanted to think they were living in harmony with nature, maybe they could sleep more peacefully. War was a human thing, but not just a human thing. And we had not added anything new to this planet. We were at war, and only I knew what that meant. But one person knowing what to do might be enough. Yuri still argued for destroying the West Thicket, but he was voted down, 24-7. I voted no because I feared that without the West Thicket as an enemy, the East Thicket might not need us. I did what I could. I transplanted snow vines and aspen trees from the East Thicket to the western edge of our fields as a shield. They thrived and attacked. We replanted our crops, and they grew unmolested. Every day I walked with a machete on the far side of our shield of vines and hacked off any west vines reaching toward it. Sometimes I found combating vines wrapped around each other in struggle, pushing and tearing. With one chop, I rescued our white knight. Underground, I knew, the battle raged even more fiercely. One afternoon, Yuri came with me, shirtless in the heat. A bandana tied across his forehead caught his sweat.
Who would think farming could be so violent?
He chopped off a vine and hurled it toward a woodpile for burning. He walked on, poking with a stick in the brush for vines hiding like snakes. This was simply weeding a garden to him. Around us, little lizards hooted under the blue sky and the small bright sun. Soon we would have our first harvest, and we were planning a feast. We had said we expected hardship, not paradise, but we really wanted both. We thought we could come in peace and find a happy niche in another ecology. Instead, we found a battlefield. The East Vine turned us into servile mercenaries, nothing more than big, clever Phippacats helping it win another battle. We had wanted to begin the world afresh, far from Earth and all its mistakes. That had not happened, but only I realized it.
and I kept my disappointment to myself. Someday I might explain to our children how we had to compromise to survive. Yuri chopped merrily away. We faced more fighting ahead, and I hoped we would be ready.
Sylvia, year 34, generation 2. Nothing herein shall be deemed to infringe on the individual freedom of belief, right to speech and justice, liberty, and the peaceful pursuit of individual aims in harmony with the welfare and interests of the Commonwealth as a whole. From the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pax. Before the roof blew away, I had to check it. I had to. And it didn't matter who said I shouldn't, or if it really wasn't safe to go upstairs. Summer meant hurricanes, and I'd dreamed of designing a beautiful building as strong as a hurricane. But I didn't get beauty or strength, because they wouldn't let me. And this hurricane. It was the first storm of the summer, and the meteorologist said it would probably be the worst ever. Rain was plowing against the lodge when Julian and I went up to the third floor. We opened the trapdoor to the attic, and I climbed up on his shoulders to look at the roof from the underside. It rocked like a boat on water. The shingles were ripped off in some places. Rain slashed in and filled the attic with the smell of drenched wood, and the wind tugged on the beams and gables and strained every joint. What if I'd woven the studs and rafters as if they were reeds? Then some wood cracked in the corner, like an exploding hydrogen cactus. "Torch!" I shouted at Julian, then motioned since he couldn't hear me over the wind. The flame flickered in the wind as he handed it up, and the air smelled of burning resin. Then a hard wind swatted the roof, and it rocked again. There was the problem. The improvised tie-down had broken at the northwest corner. I designed the roof to be set into the walls with slotted joints and cross-ties, the way the architecture text recommended. But no one had time for the complicated work. No one wanted to give time to a child's dream. They'd used poles and logs, not even sawed into real beams. They got what they wanted. Would the building survive the storm at all? I wanted doubled-up beams, corner braces, and extra ties. Extravagances, they said, and the building turned out weak, cramped, and clumsy.
Sylvia!
Julian shouted, and added something I couldn't catch. His red hair shone like flame in the torchlight, and his eyes suffered for me, for how I felt about the roof. My poor roof. I began to climb down, and there was Vera standing at the head of the stairs. She must have struggled all the way up to check on us. But why? She was the new moderator of PAX, so she ought to be concerned about the building, but we could have told her all about it. Torchlight lit her face, wrinkled like tree bark, white hair receding like a man's false teeth bared.
Julian!
She sounded like an under-oiled machine.
Why did you bring Sylvia here?
My idea! I yelled so she could hear me over the storm. Julian had followed me, trying to be helpful, but Vera ignored me and motioned for us to follow her. We trudged down the steps. The wind tore at the building the way a thipple lion's claws hunt for roots, and the plaster was cracking as the walls shuddered. Vera descended step by step, leaning on a cane. It would have been disrespectful to get ahead of her, and children must honor the parents. We'd heard that since we were born. And how could we disobey? She yelled at him all the way down, and when we arrived in the crowded dark cellar, I put out the torch and tried again. I needed to inspect the roof. I kept even a hint of disrespect out of my voice.
Julian could have gone alone and told you about it, she grunted as she lowered herself onto a bench.
But he didn't design it. He wouldn't know what to look for. She waved her cane.
It was too dangerous.
Don't worry, he murmured. He was still a teenager like me, but his beard had come in red like his hair. He got that from his mother, Paula, and a squarish face from his father, Octavo, and had a smile so wide that it made his eyes crinkle up. He patted me on the arm. She glared at his hand. Even so, I swear I wanted to like her, and I thought maybe she acted angry because she was frightened by the storm. She'd been moderator for only a month, elected after Paula's death, and I hoped that Vera would be as good as her. Paula had been too sick in her last year to be a real moderator, and I hoped that PAX would become calm and organized again. I wanted to keep building, to design strong and beautiful homes and barns and bridges. Survival was year to year, and survival came first. But beauty was good for the soul. Several Earth texts said that, and Earth couldn't have been all bad. My mother, Half-Foot Wendy, was sitting with Octavo. His white hair and beard looked bright in the dim light of oil lamps. I headed toward them, zigzagging because all 28 residents of the lodge and their possessions crowded the room, all their clothes, beds, tools, medical equipment, and robots. There were three other older lodges, also probably having trouble in a storm so fierce, with cellars full of people, but the cellars were sturdy. Everyone understood the importance of that. Mama smiled at me as if I'd gone for a stroll to pick friendly fruit, with a wide smile like Julian's, but the corners of her mouth disappeared into her jowls. Her face had once been smooth and full like mine. I'd seen the pictures, but she wasn't made for this gravity. It had pulled her face down, and her breasts, knees, arms, all her flesh drooped. On Earth, according to the parents, I'd be light as a leaf. "It was a good design," Mama said. "It was my first real building." "Not your fault," Octavo said, but he wasn't looking at me. Mama wanted to go to the gift center, and I helped her stand and walk. The top of my head only reached her shoulder, because Pax gravity had made us children short and strong and fast, like native animals. The parents were crippled after a lifetime of falls and struggling, no matter how many times the medics rebuilt their bones and joints. "Not bad in here yet," she called from the gift center, which was just big buckets, not a real outhouse, and it didn't stink yet. But we'd be stuck in the cellar for 2 days with no chance to make a gift to a friendly plant, and they'd get full. She limped out and took my shoulder again. "Do you know why Vera yells at Julian?" she whispered, and put her arm around my shoulders. "Octavo told me. Julian's sterile." "Sterile?" I was so surprised I didn't say anything. Mama shook her head and patted my cheek, because she knew I liked Julian. Sterility was the pack's curse. That's what the parents muttered. And population was the pack's problem. Half the parents were dead now, and they'd had only 24 surviving children, and half the cache of sperm and ova from Earth had been lost in a refrigeration failure in a storm. We children had produced only 13 grandchildren so far, none for me, and I was now 18 Earth years old, 14 Pax years, and fertile, and a lot of parents thought I had a duty to fulfill. "You have time," Mama always said, but other parents were impatient. I saw how mothers loved their children, and I couldn't stand to love anything that much yet, because sometimes babies died, even before they were born. What if my baby died? We made the usual hurricane meal that evening, fancy Fippo cat stew, fragrant with onions and potatoes, but I didn't eat much. I minded Nicoletta's toddler while she fed her father. Later, Ramona wanted to play Go, and how can you say no to a parent, especially a bossy one like her? So we played, and I won, probably because I could see better. Eventually, the roof blew off. The wood tore horribly until there was a thud and shake of released pressure, then rain blasted louder than ever against the attic floor. No one said anything. Without the tug from the roof, the building seemed to creak less. I was sitting on my cot with a piece of paper, designing a temporary roof, when Julian sat down next to me and put his arm around me. I closed my eyes and leaned against him, hoping Vera was watching. I wished I were on Earth. In my earliest memories, I thought Pax was somewhere on Earth, because the names of so many things were the same here as in the educational programs. But there were big differences, too, so later I thought there was some elaborate Earth-Pax distinction about animals and plants and food. I worried that Earth and all its tall, fragile people, with their multi-part names, might be just on the other side of the lake and might cross it, because they'd made Earth a living hell. The parents always said so. But then I understood that Earth was far away, just a computer library of texts, music, and pictures about complicated histories and places I'd never visit, and eventually saw less of as the computers broke down. Besides us, there was no intelligent life on Pax, just the snow vines and some sneaky carnivores. That disappointed the parents and me, too, when I realized that the only new people I'd ever meet were new babies. I wished for aliens. The architecture texts, when I could access them, showed beautiful and inspiring buildings, completely impossible because we didn't have pre-stressed concrete or structural steel. In fact, hardly any iron, because the satellite hadn't found any ore deposits. We had only bricks and lumber, but I tried to learn what was practical and apply it. And now my first building was falling apart on top of me, because people who hadn't studied architecture were sure they knew better. Vera stayed anxious during the whole storm, organizing teams to mop up leaks and cook meals. Nights were the worst. It was early lights out because the parents wanted to sleep, but they never slept well, waking at any noise, every clap of thunder, shuffling again and again to the gift center, and snoring louder than the roaring wind, then early lights on when they were done with what passed for sleep. They kept me awake, and I began to act like them, inattentive, irritable, and forgetful, chronically sleep-deprived because the days and nights were too short for the parents who'd been born on Earth. I wished I were somewhere else. As soon as the storm calmed, 2 days after the roof was torn off, I slipped out of the damp and stinking cellar, finally, with some other children. I went to the lake with Julian and tall, skinny Alosha, who were both hunters, and Daniel, who fished and was almost 30 years old. We wanted to see how the boats had fared and what had washed up on shore. It was still raining hard, and the clouds were low and dark. We were wrapped in downy acetate ponchos like cocoons, but our feet were drenched. Puddles and streamlets were everywhere. Everything we walked past was damaged. Buildings and irrigation canals and farm fields, and the disaster would look even worse when the sun came out. Even some of the aspen trees in the snowvine thicket had fallen, although the thicket itself remained sturdy in a way that I envied. The river through the friendly thicket was flooded. The lake was flooded, too, with only a narrow strip of sand between the water and the tree line. The other rivers were probably flooded, but we couldn't see them through the rain. The white-capped waves were dirty brown from all the soil washed into the water. Rain rattled on the surface of the water and made it dull as the clouds. The boats had been hauled up beyond the tree line and lashed tightly. Daniel, who always worried, checked the boats. "They look good," he said, relieved. I checked the wicker fish trap stored under them. They looked good, too. Wicker was the reason I'd come to the beach. I made baskets. After storms, fresh reeds and vines would wash up on the beach, brought to the lake by the flooding rivers, and there were usually dead knot-ons from the lake, the swimming plants that dried into silky soft fibers. I also hoped that a roof beam might be floating around, because we could salvage the nails at least. Julian and Alosha found an injured Fippo lion. I didn't look as they pulled out their knives and ended its whimpers. It would be a lot of meat, tough and not nearly as good as deer crab, but we'd have enough to eat. I saw strange flashes of color in a mat of branches that had washed on shore. I got closer and saw rainbow-striped pieces of stems and twigs. But a hungry lizard or worse might be riding in the mat, so I teased out some pieces with a stick. Finger-wide rainbows alternated with black bands on the twigs, worn and scratched, but still beautiful, and I could weave extraordinary things with it. I took all I could and stuffed it into my bag. I hoped I'd find more down the beach. On the way, I saw something pink in the sand, maybe a chunk of rose quartz, so I checked. A pretty stone could be beautiful, too. Closer, I saw shiny yellow metal with it. Maybe it was a bit from one of the landing pods that had crashed 34 years ago. I dug it out of the wet sand and let the rain wash it clean. It was a glass ball, solid and heavy, the size of a baby's fist and faceted, worn on the surface but clear where it was chipped, wrapped in a spiral band of gold. The gold was battered, but I could still see writing engraved in a kind of alphabet I'd never seen in history texts. Just lines and triangles. I turned it around and around in my hands and tried to imagine what it was. A machine part? I knew what most machine parts looked like, even if I wasn't a technician, and a few lenses sort of looked like this. But lenses were small. A decoration? We didn't have many decorations, and nothing like this because gold was too useful to be wasted. A piece of ore? Not even possible. Maybe something natural? Even more impossible. It wasn't like anything I knew. Finally, I began to realize that the only things I knew were either natural or human-made. Maybe I couldn't recognize the ball, because it wasn't either. Maybe it had been made by another kind of sentient being. Maybe someone else lived on Pax. Someone who could make things. Someone who could write and handle metal and glass and make something beautiful with it. This ball had sat in the bottom of the lake or washed in from a river or some traveler had left it behind. Someone else lived on Pax. Maybe we could find them. Julian and Alosha had tied the dead Fippo lion to a fallen branch and were hoisting it up, a male big enough to tear apart snow vines with front claws like machetes. They wobbled with its weight. The rain was falling harder. I ran up and held out the ball. My hand trembled. "I don't think this is ours," I said. "Look, I think this is something alien. I mean, Pax. Really, we're aliens. It has writing. I found it. Really different writing. It's beautiful, isn't it? And it was in the sand over there, and it's not human." I realized I wasn't making sense. Julian set the branch on his shoulder and put his hands around mine to steady it. He looked at the ball for what seemed like a long time. Then he smiled wider than he ever had. Daniel ran over to see what we were excited about, and we all started talking at once. "This is gold. Look, and glass. We don't make things like this. What is it? Let me hold it." "It's beautiful." Alosha howled like a lion. "Something, someone, made this," I said. "We're not alone. Not here. Not on Pax. Not in the universe." We stared at it for a moment. "There's intelligent life here besides us," I said. "Somewhere nearby." "Nearby?" Alosha echoed, squinting. He didn't always catch on fast. "How old is this?" Julian said. "The wearer should tell us something," Daniel said. He took it and turned it around in his hand slowly. "It can't be that old. I mean, not thousands of years." "So they're still alive," I said. Daniel handed it back to me, and for a moment I was surprised to feel it was wet because I'd forgotten we were standing in the middle of a rainstorm. I was drenched and rain was pelting on the ball in my hand, and all our faces were dripping. But I didn't care. We weren't alone on Pax.
"What's it for?" Alosha asked.
"Maybe," I said. "It's an invitation. We need to find them." Julian smiled. "Soon." When we got to the village, he and Alosha had to take the lion to be dressed out, and Daniel went to report to the fishing team while I headed straight for the lodge, where Vera should probably be. The reek from the basement hit me as soon as I opened the door. I knew I shouldn't go into the basement and trip over everything, so I had someone ask her to come up. She huffed up the steps, looking anxious.
"Is there a problem? Did we lose the boats?"
"No, they're fine, but..."
"The fields?"
"Well, they're flooded, and there's damage, and buildings, too, but..." She shook her head and closed her eyes and sighed.
"This is hard. So hard."
"I found this." I held out the ball. Maybe it would cheer her up. She opened her eyes and stared at it blankly. "I think it was made by some other intelligent life," I said. "It was at the lake." Terrell had come up behind her. He was a parent and metallurgist. So I said, "That's gold around it. We should look for whoever made it." He was tall and as thin as a parasitized aspen, so when he nudged Vera, she had to look up to see his face as they exchanged a look. They were interested, so I pulled out some rainbow twigs. "I found these, too." They stiffened with surprise, but Vera said,
We don't have time for that. Not now. There's too much to do.
She took the ball from my hand. I'll put it on the agenda for the next meeting.
But the next Commonwealth meeting was in 4 days. 4 days!
Still, people heard about the ball and wanted to see it that night in the dark cellar as we ate dinner. Ramona said,
It looks like a Christmas ornament.
And she began to sing a Christmas song, but Brian, another parent, complained that Christmas was a nightmare.
Arguing over the past, said Rosemary, a child a little older than me, and Brian overheard and scolded her for disrespecting the parents.
I'd read about Christmas, and frivolity was the word I remembered, and frivolity seemed interesting, and unlikely on Pax.
Survival first. There was a lot to repair and replant, but there always was.
Is this really better than Earth? Nicoletta had whispered once when we were young and no parents were around. Now she worked as my mother's replacement, scavenging parts from the failed radio system to repair the medical tomography equipment, and if there were parts left over, to keep the weeding machines running. Machines did mindless tasks, so we had time to care for sick parents or prepare for the next storm or preserve what food we had for winter. Nicoletta had borne 3 babies already, and 2 lived. When we were young, we used to coil her curly black hair into ringlets. These days, she had no time for fussing with her hair, and sometimes she cried for no reason. Daniel fished, but the lake became anaerobic during the bad droughts, and all the fish died. My brother tried to enrich the soil in the fields, and complained that the snow vines took the nutrients as fast as he could fertilize, but snow vine fruit kept everyone fed when crops failed or were destroyed by storms. Sometimes, Octavo would stare at nothing and grumble,
Parameters. Fibocatsier. Yuri, let's go weeding.
Yuri had died 10 years ago. Octavo was sick and would die soon, too, and I'd miss him because he was always patient with me. I was in the plaza weaving a thatch frame for a temporary roof for the lodge when Octavo limped up to ask for a sample of the rainbow bamboo, as he called it.
Something for the meeting, he said,
and coughed with a wheezing bark.
Something that needs an explanation.
He knew plants better than anyone, and I wondered what there was to explain. But thunderstorms arrived on the meeting night, and no building could hold all residents at once, although we were only 62 people. The roof thatched with plastic bark on my lodge held with hardly a leak, and some people congratulated me, but not Vera. She was still proving she was moderator and reorganizing our rooms because a lot of them had been damaged in the big hurricane, even though we'd already rearranged ourselves without her help, and no one was complaining. I went to the closet that was my new room, with nothing but a cot and 1 box that held everything I owned. So angry, I almost cried. I should have known then what I realized later, that we wouldn't have voted to investigate the glassmakers anyway. The parents would have voted no. The children would have voted the way their parents did, and even the grandchildren would follow their parents' parents. Children didn't think for themselves. We did what we were told because we'd been convinced that we didn't really understand things well enough to make our own decisions. That's what we were told all the time, and how could we argue with that? We were supposed to be happy to be just like the parents, and working together in harmony mattered more than thinking as individuals. We were still children, even though most of us were 20 or 30 years old. What would happen when all the parents died? Octavo came to talk to me the next day while I was working in a corner of the plaza next to Snowman, the big old snow vine. I was making a basket for collecting pond grubs, a wide hoop basket with loosely attached ribs, so it would be soft and flexible, because the grubs burst so easily. I was thinking about the meeting we should have held. Why wasn't Vera interested in something as big as another intelligent species nearby, when something as small as who slept on the sunrise side of a lodge fascinated her? I could hear her laughing as I worked. She was sitting with some other parents at the far corner of the plaza, cleaning trilobites. Stinky work. So they were as far from the lodges and the meal area as they could get, and I couldn't hear the words, just occasional laughter. She always worked hard, and the parents and some children liked her leadership, and I still wanted to like her, but all I had were questions. Octavo lowered himself onto a bench, panting. I pulled out some coese, twine, and anchored the ribs first on one side of the loop, and then on the other. He couldn't tolerate certain fungus spores, and his lungs had been regrown 3 times, but they worked less efficiently each time. The same thing had been killing my father, Merle, when a pack of ground eagles got him first. Our hunters tracked down the pack, the last one to bother us, and we put a bouquet of spiny eagle feathers on Papa's grave. "A Coke would be nice right now," Octavo finally said. Coke was some sort of earth drink. "You know, snowvine fruit looks a lot like that glass ball. Those same surface facets when they're immature." I glanced up. "Is that important?" He pulled out the rainbow bamboo twig I'd given him. "Pax is 1 billion years older than Earth. It has had time for more evolution." I finished a weaver and reached for another, thought again, and picked a coil of greener coese so I could make a striped basket. "We should find the people who made the ball."
"It might not be that easy, girl. There are 2 intelligences. The ball is obvious, but the bamboo, it belongs to the snowvine family. We set Fippo lions to graze on the west vine, and the east vine rejoiced. Our loyal master."
He paused again to catch his breath and gazed across the plaza. I kept weaving, wondering why he was complaining about the snow vines again.
"This bamboo," he said, "displays a representation of a rainbow, not a refraction like the surface of a bubble. This is made with chromoplasts. Plants can see. They grow toward light and observe its angle to know the season. They recognize colors. This one made colors on its bark to show something. It is a signal that this plant is intelligent. It can interpret the visual spectrum and control its responses."
"So it wants to attract us? Attract intelligent beings, I mean?"
"No. A signal to beware. Like thorns. Who knows what a plant might be thinking? I doubt they have a natural tenderness for animals. We are conveniences."
"But the glass ball is beautiful. It's a fruit, you said. So it must have come from a plant that was friendly, or the glassmakers wouldn't have made such a nice copy of it. Maybe it came from the rainbow bamboo, since it's like snowvine fruit. We should find it."
Octavo was staring across the plaza. Vera was getting up. He turned to me.
"Snowvines are not especially intelligent. Less than a wolf. Well, you have never seen wolves or even dogs. But this rainbow bamboo... you can predict animals, but not plants. They never think like we do. It might not be friendly."
"If the snow vines can decide to give us fruit, then the rainbow bamboo might give us fruit, too. We always need food, and a more intelligent plant would know how much we can do for it in exchange for food."
"Exactly. Plants always want something."
He glanced at Vera, who was walking toward us.
"But this coese twine, tell me, have you noticed a difference in fibers in the different colors?"
I frowned. Why was he asking that? But I wanted to be polite, so I picked up samples of each color and flexed them. "No, I think the greener is just picked younger." Vera came up to us and stopped. Octavo looked at her.
"We have been discussing coese. It could have many uses. Perhaps like flax. We have been too focused on food sources, I think."
"We always need food," she said. They were silent for a while, and since I wouldn't be interrupting, I said, "I've been thinking about the glass and rainbow bamboo. When can we discuss it at a meeting?"
"Not soon," she said. "We still haven't recovered from the hurricane."
I tried to hide my disappointment, but she was staring at my basket instead of me anyway. The stripe looked good. "That's the natural variation of the coese fiber," I murmured. "Efficient," she said, and hobbled away.
We'll never discuss it, I said. Paula wasn't like that.
Octavo never scolded when the children complained.
Paula had training.
He looked at the twig.